For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Psalm chapter 23, verse 1. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Very powerful psalm. And we learn that it's a psalm of David. And of course, David himself, writing about God as a shepherd, David himself was a shepherd as a little boy. And if Mike Rowe was doing the show Dirty Jobs 3,000 years ago, he would have been interviewing David about being a shepherd. This was tough, gruesome work. And so David himself was a shepherd, and he's kind of reflecting over his life, and he's realizing, you know, just like I was a shepherd to these sheep, God is really my shepherd. And so that's really the good news of this passage, that God is our shepherd. The bad news is that we are the sheep. And you might look at that and say, well, I don't mind being a cute little furry sheep with his tongue sticking out. Well, apparently you don't know sheep that well, do you? Huh? Sheep are dirty animals. Have you ever spent time with sheep? I never have. They're disgusting. They're filthy. They're dumb. They're stupid, stupid animals. We read in USA Today, 2005, 450 sheep jumped to their deaths in Turkey. Look at the way this opens. This is the best opener of any news article ever. For... I can't say it. First, one sheep jumped to its death. Then stunned Turkish shepherds watched as nearly 1,500 others followed, each leaping off the same cliff. In the end, 450 dead animals lay on top of one another in a billowy white pile. Now, wait a minute. That math doesn't add up there. It said 1,500 sheep fell off the cliff, but 450 died. What's with the other 1,000? Those who jumped later were saved as the pile got higher and the fall more cushioned. So first, it's just a mixture of, you know, soft, white, and red, gooey sheep at the bottom. There's nothing we can do, said the shepherd. They're all wasted, whose sheep were grazing together in the herd. They're stupid, stupid animals. They make cats and dogs look like geniuses by comparison. Sheep. They're also defenseless. You know, they don't have like some kind of a sweet venom or like a stegosaurus tail or, you know, claws or, you know, or like a sheep Rambo or something like that to defend itself. They don't have any kind of defenses. So they're weak. They're dumb, they're defenseless, they're also pretty anxious, which would seem to follow. I mean, if you're not the sharpest tool in the shed, in the animal order, you're not that strong, you're not that tough, tenacious, that would lead to a little bit of distress, anxiety. W. Philip Keller, who is a shepherd back during the Great Depression, he has an interesting look at this psalm. He wrote a whole book about this psalm. And as a shepherd, he has particularly keen insights into the nature of sheep. He says, the strange thing about sheep is that because of their very makeup, it is almost impossible for them to be made to lie down. Owing to their timidity, they refuse to lie down unless they are free from all fear. If tormented by flies or parasites, sheep won't lie down. Only when free of these pests can they relax. It is only the shepherd who can provide release from these anxieties. The sheep are very skittish. You know, to lie down as a sheep, when basically everything from a lion to a wolf to a jackal, even to a parasite or a bug, these flies will actually lay their larvae inside the sheep's nose. They are just totally, totally defenseless. And so it takes the shepherd to actually calm down these poor little animals to get them just to roll over. They're also very demanding. Because they're so stupid, Sheep will just, you know, they feel hunger, eat. They feel thirsty, drink. And they will just go off into any direction. And they're constantly leaving their shepherd. And so that's why the shepherd is constantly trying to draw them back into the fold. Keller, again, he says, when sheep are thirsty, they become restless and set out in search of water to satisfy their thirst. If not led to the good water supplies, they will often end up drinking from the polluted potholes where they pick up internal parasites. Sheep don't just take care of themselves, as some might suppose. They require more than any other class of livestock, endless attention and meticulous care. Now, I'm not making an argument here, but it makes me wonder, how does evolution explain for sheep? This is like a Darwinistic cul-de-sac where, and I'm just like, I don't know. I know that there's an explanation. I just don't know how sheep survived without shepherds. They basically are just completely dumb, defenseless, distressed, demanding. They drink parasitic water. They're ugly. And they're pretty desperate, really desperate. Again, Keller, he says, a cast sheep. This refers to when a sheep falls over and lays on its back. It's referred to a cast sheep. He says it's a very pathetic sight. Lying on its back with its feet in the air, it flays away frantically, struggling to stand up without success. Sometimes it will bleat a little for help, but generally it lies there lashing about in a frightened frustration. If the owner doesn't arrive on the scene within a reasonably short time, the sheep will die. The way it happens is this. A heavy, fat, or long-fleeced sheep will lie down comfortably in some little hollow or depression in the ground. It may roll on its side slightly to stretch out or relax. Suddenly, the center of gravity in the body shifts so that it turns on its back far enough that the feet no longer touch the ground. So he's describing like a turtle on its back, only this is a mammal, this is a sheep. And it's just kind of like going for a stretch and then whoop, dead. It may feel a sense of panic and start to paw frantically. Frequently, this only makes things worse. It rolls over even further. Now it is quite impossible for it to regain its feet. As it lies there struggling, gases begin to build up in the rumen. A sheep are ruminants, which means that they chew, they swallow, they regurgitate their food. Four different stomachs. One of the stomachs is called the rumen, where the food breaks down inside the stomach and it becomes very gaseous. And so it turns into somewhat of a balloon. So when the sheep is on its back, it becomes very bottom heavy, and the air and the gas. So it's a gassy, fat animal laying there looking up frantically. How did I get into this situation? I was just trying to stretch. As these expand, they tend to slow and cut off the blood circulation to the extremities of the body, especially the legs. If the weather is very hot and sunny, a cast sheep can die in a few hours. If it is cool, cloudy, and rainy, it may survive in this position for several days. So in case you weren't picking this up as we're studying about the sheep, in this metaphor, we are the sheep. How's that feel? I know many of us are thinking to ourselves, defenseless, man, I do CrossFit and, you know, parkour or whatever. And dumb, I'm not that dumb, you know. I think pretty good. And now, from God's perspective, you know, from an infinite personal God's perspective, looking down at me, I must be no more impressive than a termite in intelligence and power, strength, and really the ability to govern and lead my life. God looks at me as a shepherd would look at a sheep. Now, I don't mean to push this metaphor too far to basically dehumanize us. That's not the point. The point is that this is metaphorical of something. And it's metaphorical of the fact that we need a humble posture before the shepherd. To be able to admit that here I'm coming to the shepherd with needs, with distress, with really a limited purview and vantage point, that I can't see everything that I need. And I make pretty foolish, demanding, anxious decisions all the time. And I need a shepherd in my life. That's what I need. And so David says, "The Lord is my shepherd." And we need this. That's what this passage is teaching. Now, many of us, as we start to think about taking on a leader in our lives, we become very suspicious because we can think through a litany of people that have let us down and that have hurt us over the years. where we have entrusted ourselves to other people and we've been burned. And quite frankly, I'm sympathetic to that fact. I've been hurt. I've been betrayed. And I can feel that feeling of, you know, wanting to give over leadership and direction of your life and to be suspicious that if I hand over the keys to the car, what could happen? It's a very scary proposition. That's scary. I'll tell you what's even scarier is the alternative. The alternative of autonomy. Auto means self, and nomos means law or rule, self-rule. The idea that I'm just going to be the captain of my own ship. Yeah, well, the ship is sinking, all right? And for me to stand here and say, well, I don't need any kind of direction in my life, you know, whatever I say goes, whatever I come up with as far as a philosophical worldview or a direction, a purpose, a meaning, all the while knowing that this is just subjective in my heart. It really has no external meaning whatsoever. That I'm a blip on the radar in the cosmic scheme of things. And that's it. Life is over. You're gone. There was this incredibly artistic film back from 1990. It was referred to as Home Alone with Macaulay Culkin. It's almost 30 years old at this point. I grew up, well, I wanted to be this character. Now, 30 years later, I'm like, I'm so glad I'm not Macaulay Culkin. But in the movie, it's kind of this interesting picture where Macaulay Culkin wakes up and his whole family goes out to France, Paris, France. He wakes up and he realizes, Mom, Dad, he's walking around in his PJs and all of a sudden he realizes the house is empty. They're gone. He doesn't know where they went. They're gone. And now all of a sudden he's the king of the kingdom. And so he does whatever he wants. You know, he just eats pizza like crazy, watches, you know, dirty movies. He's, you know, going wild. Stuffing his face with candy. And, you know, it's just really, as a kid, you're looking at that and you're like, oh, man, I really wish my parents would just go to France for a while because that'd be so awesome. You know, no rules, no direction, no any of that. Just, you know, be free unto myself. Man, would that be awesome. And really, as you start to discover, this is really a microcosm, a picture of what it's like to be home alone in the universe, where we look out at the universe. You know, picture it like this. Imagine if you believed in a creator God, but you didn't think that he loved you. Maybe a deistic view of God, that, you know, he cranked up the machine of the universe and then he let it play out, but he doesn't really love you. You know, think about how scary that would be to believe that God exists, but he doesn't love you. Let me push it one step further. What if there is no God? Then what created you? Well, the accidental pregnancy of matter and energy and chance and time, they don't care for you. It's a deaf, dumb universe. It doesn't care for you. There's no holds barred. We are truly alone. We're the cosmic orphan. And yeah, that idea that, yeah, I'm just going to be autonomous and no one's going to tell me what to do, not even God himself, that has certain privileges. And yet, really, when we look at that alternative, it's just untenable, unfeasible. Really, the horror of looking out of your life and seeing there's no point here. The benefits of having a leader like God in your life. It's not like a human leader where they can be fallible, where they can break your trust. That happens. People are fallen. The benefits of having God as a leader is that you have a strong and loving leader in your life. Not just that he's loving and that he cares for you, but that he's strong and he can defend you. And that's really what we see in this psalm, is David is just so happy to be in God's presence. And to know that God is strong enough to care for him and to love him. He also says, I shall not want. That's another benefit of having a leader in your life, a shepherd. Contentment. Wouldn't that be nice? You know, instead of being in the rat race where you're constantly trying to get more and more and more and you're clawing for more and hungry for more, you want to have a certain image and you want to look a certain way and have a certain, you know, appearance and prestige. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just wake up every morning and look at yourself in the mirror and just be happy with who you are? Just to be happy that you know God, and more importantly, that he knows you. And just to feel like everything else in my life is just happiness upon happiness on top of that. To feel like if I only had God, I'd have everything. And to have anything on top of that is just gratuitous. It's just even better. Contentment. He He says he makes me lie down, makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. This would be another benefit of the shepherd. Shepherds in the ancient Near East would have to lead the sheep into grassy terrain. The sheep couldn't find this on their own. It would be very confusing. They would never be able to get through the rocky crags to get to the place where they could eat. And David is basically saying, that's the way God is in my life. That if it wasn't for God, I'd be completely directionless. I wouldn't know up from down, which is pretty comforting. When you're making these huge decisions, like I remember thinking to myself when I was getting married, you know, I was in love with my fiance. I was happy. The relationship was going excellent. I'm really excited, everything else. And yet you start to think of all the different contingencies that could happen. You know, what if this went wrong? What if that went wrong? How do I really know I'm making the right choice here? How do I know that? You think about these other big decisions in life. We really have such a limited vision of the future. To be able to predict what's going to happen, we really don't know. There's no guarantees. And to know that we are following an omniscient, an all-knowing being who's charting out a direction, and that we can be inside of his will, which Romans 12:3 says is good, pleasing, and perfect. Boy, that would be safe. That would be so safe to know you're in the center of God's will. He knows how to provide, and he knows how to give us rest. Matthew 11:28, Jesus says, "Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, my burden is light." Yeah, it's an interesting picture. For those of us who are into this project of wanting to serve in the cause of Christ, and we start to feel really weary and burdened all the time, something's wrong. Jesus said, "My yoke is easy, my burden is light." Now there's a yoke. That means that we have to work. We're working alongside Jesus. And at the same time, he says, when you take on my yoke, you come with me, it's going to be light, it's going to be easy. And we should have that attitude that he's going to feed me, give me the energy, and the sustaining ability to keep moving forward. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. It's interesting, this word for restored, it's used in the Old Testament to refer to being restored after having a moral fall. Like, let's say you have a moral failing and you're trying to pick up the pieces. That's the word. He restores my soul. Which this would mean that he's gracious to me. How's that for a leader? Not a hardliner, not a strict overlord, some kind of a cosmic cretin who's just there waiting for you, just waiting so he can bring the hammer or the ruler down. Apparently, this ruler is going to guide and provide and give you direction. He's going to give you love and leadership. And you can't fail him. Even when you fail, he's gracious to you. He covers that with his love and just wants you to get right back up. I remember having a moral fall that was pretty serious, and a buddy of mine, after I had it, he just came up to me and he was just like, "Don't even worry about that. That's in the past. Just keep going. Don't worry about that." Philippians 3, forgetting what lies behind, reaching forward to the prize, to the goal, reaching out is the word. To forget it and to realize I'm under grace. And to sit there and to be restored every day, that even though I've got all my foibles and faults and failings, God is there saying, "You're forgiven." And it's for his namesake. I like that. At first, I don't like that. I'd rather it say for James Rochford's namesake. But for his namesake, that means it's not about me. This would mean that I'm being connected into some kind of a transcendent, eternal cause. It's so interesting, the people, they don't feel a sense of purpose unless they're part of something greater than themselves. And here we have the ultimate cause, the cause of Christ. To be able to see people leave separation and alienation from God and to move over into a love relationship with God, which lasts forever. What greater of a cause could there be? And he's going to lead me in this path of righteousness for his namesake. It's incredible. And it's interesting, that term for path is used throughout the Bible some 600 times. And this is the way that God wants to describe what it's like to follow him. We like to think of it like, you know, if you're walking a path, like it's a race, or that, you know, we're doing like somersaults or something like that. You know, obviously that can't be the description. Silly. A path is just right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot, repeat. And as you're walking a path, you just don't really feel like you're moving anywhere. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, minutes go by and then hours go by and days go by and weeks, years. And then eventually you look back and you realize, I've come a long way here. That didn't feel like I was really moving that much. And yet, whoa, there were whole miles I passed by. And man, that's what it's like following Christ too. We often can't see it. We can't see the progress. We have to be able to listen to other people who say, dude, you're really growing, even though you can't see it. It's a path. It's right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot. And over time, we see that this really grows into something that's incredible. Well, he says in verse 4, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Let's think of this first clause here, walking through the valley of the shadow of death. This could be a superlative. It doesn't mean that it's a literal valley of death. It could refer to various threats of all stripes. So this could refer to anxiety, crisis, pain, not always death, although certainly it would refer to death. And he says, I walk through this valley. You would think that if you were walking through one of these valleys as a shepherd with the sheep, you know, there's bandits, there's wolves and lions. You'd think you'd be running through that valley. And instead, the picture is just walking. Think of the poise. Think of the courage that would take to be able just to walk through a fearful, scary, dark valley. How could you possibly do that? With no fear? With no fear in your heart, in the valley of the shadow of death. You know, to us, we think of valleys as happy places, like on all the valleys. Back in the ancient times, valleys were the scary places. And he's saying, I will fear no evil. Why? For you are with me. And so here we have another incredible benefit of having a good shepherd in our lives. Freedom from fear. Many people hear this, and this just kind of, I don't know, it kind of blanks out. Like there's this album I like by Jeff Buckley. He's an incredible singer-songwriter, died before his time at the age of 30, 1997. I read his biography. I'm a huge fan, okay? I've listened to his album. He's only got one album out. I've listened to it somewhere on the order of 500 to a million times, okay? And I've listened to it over and over and over. And you know what? To this day, there are still some lyrics I don't know to the songs on that album. And that could be you, where it's like you've heard the same thing over and over and over, and you're like, yeah, the Bible says I shouldn't fear. In fact, this is the number one command in the Bible, do not be afraid. And you just read through, yeah, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. And then the other, you know, 23 and a half hours out of the day, you're scared to death. Have you really let this sink in here? That no matter how scary it gets, and I've got God, Almighty God, next to me. He says he's with me. How bad could this get? If he's going to walk through this with me, not from afar, but imminently with me, how bad can this get? What's going to happen? I die? Oh, man, that's terrible. I go to heaven. Oh, I can't fail. I'm untouchable. To know that we don't suffer alone. I don't know if you've ever been at the bedside of someone who's dying and to sit there and to watch them, you know, take their last breaths. And to know that you're with them is they're going to face their valley of the shadow of death. You know, you could be with them, but every single human being is going to face that valley alone. You can't go with them. You can be with them on this side, but when they pass over into the next life, there is no one that's going to be with them except for God. And God is calling out to you here tonight, saying that when you finally, your time is up, I want to be there with you when you face death so that you don't have to worry about where you're going to spend your eternity, but you're going to know I'm with you and you don't have to do this alone. He also says, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. So another benefit of the shepherd, again, is the direction, the rod, and is it 1 Samuel 17:35. David uses it as a rod to protect his sheep, but it's also used as kind of a way to give direction to the sheep, like when the sheep is kind of going one way, just a little, you know, to the head, and then goes the other way. And sometimes we need that from God. God wants to give us a little bit of direction. I can't tell you how many times I was set out on a path that seemed so clear at the time, and then God would intervene in different ways and just kind of give you a little bit of a turn on the rudder so the boat would go in a different direction. And years later, I'm just saying, God, thank you, God, for not answering those prayers, because that would have been the worst thing in the world. So he brings direction, and he also brings protection for our lives. This means that not in a sense that you're never going to get sick, you're never going to get hurt, suffer. Obviously, he says we're going through the valley of the shadow of death. Christians are going to suffer just like everyone else. But to know that, as the Bible teaches, that when we live our lives for Christ, there is nothing that can stop us from fulfilling the good works that God has planned ahead of us. Ephesians 2:10. He's got these prepared, and so if he's got those prepared, I don't need to worry that I'm going to die prematurely. If I'm in his will, God's like, I'm going to see you right to the end. And so if my time's up, he's going to take me. But I can know this isn't going to be outside of his plan whatsoever. Then he says in verse 5, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. So here it's switching the metaphor from a shepherd and a sheep to a king and his prince. And to be there at the table, and the enemies are there. They're not getting any of the wine. They're not getting any of the food. He says, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. So the enemies are present, but I'm untouchable, is what he's saying. You anoint my head with oil. This could be in the sense that he's being, you know, christened as a king. And my cup overflows. I really love that imagery. Like if you've ever gone out to one of these ritzy bars and you're like, yeah, I'll have a glass of wine. And they, you know, pour you like a mouthful at the bottom. And they're like, here you go. And you're like, oh, can you give it another shot there? You know, this is completely the other picture. The cup is overflowing with wine. Wow. The picture that God is just going to come into your life to ruin it and to control everything and to turn you into some kind of a weirdo nerd and everything's going to be boring. My cup overflows, pal. Benefits of the shepherd would be that he's going to bring way more love and happiness into your life than you could ever imagine. And so the suffering piece is there, but we got this piece as well. That honestly, looking back, when I first came to Christ, September of 2004, I had no idea it was going to be this amazing. No idea. And honestly, I can say, each year it gets better than the last. You start to learn more, you feel closer with God. Just to see people come to meet God is just, it's hard to put into words. It feels so satisfying, makes you happy. Having relationships, I never thought I'd be able to have that. And way more than I could ever ask for. Surely, he concludes, goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. So this is a case in Hebrew poetry of what's called intensification. That's where the second strophe intensifies the first. So it shall follow me all the days of my life, line A, forever, line B. So a final benefit of having this kind of a leader in your life is that he solves the greatest existential question we have. What happens to me once I die? According to this passage here, God is saying he is going to be with you forever. When you come to meet him, you are secure. No, God didn't want you to walk around each day worrying and wondering, you know, if I die, I wonder if I was good enough. I wonder if I'm going to wake up and I'm going to wake up in hell. What a terrifying prospect that would be. To live your whole life with that hanging over your head. Is it oblivion? Is it judgment? What is it over my head? And God says, I don't want you to ever, ever, ever worry about that. I love you too much to worry about that hanging over your head. I don't want you to worry about where you're going to spend eternity. I want you to be secure, have security in where you'll be in eternity. And he's going to be with us forever. Well, what's interesting about this psalm is that this was written about 1000 BC. About 500 years later, there was this prophet by the name of Ezekiel. And he was writing, I don't know, at the beginning of the 6th century BC. And he had this to say when he was talking about God. He said, you know, God was looking at all these shepherds of his people. And the shepherds were there, and they're evil shepherds, evil rulers and priests and prophets. They were just evil men who were leading his people. And so in Ezekiel 34, God says this. He says, my sheep wandered over all the mountains and on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them. I am against the shepherds and will hold them accountable for my flock. I will rescue my flock from their mouths, and it will no longer be food for them. I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so I will look for my sheep. I will rescue them from all the places where they're scattered, and I will bring them into their own land. I will pasture them on the mountains of Israel. I will tend them in a good pasture. I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord. I will search for the lost and bring them back. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak, but the sleek and the strong I will destroy. I will shepherd the flock with justice. I'm not going to delegate this to someone else. I'm going to do it. I'm going to be the shepherd. There's no shepherd out there that can do this. I will do it. And then 500 years more go by. And there's this very interesting Jewish Palestinian rabbi who comes on the scene in the first century AD. And he starts to teach, and all these people start to listen to him. They're like, boy, this guy talks with authority. And at one point, this rabbi named Jesus, in John chapter 10, he said, I tell you the truth. I am the gate for the sheep. All whoever came before me, they were the thieves and the robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. He will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief, he comes only to steal and to kill and to destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the fullest. I am the good shepherd. So much for that idea that you hear from people who say, oh yeah, Jesus never claimed to be God. Okay, you got to open up your eyes a little bit. Ezekiel 34, he says, I am going to do it. I'm the shepherd. I'm the shepherd. And then Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. Remember, we talked about how being a shepherd would have been a dirty job in, you know, 1000 BC. So in a sense, this passage really makes us look bad because we're the sheep. But it also condescends God because he's willing to take up the most dirty, disgusting job in the universe, that of a shepherd. So much so that Jesus calls himself a shepherd, and even so much so that he says the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And that's the message of the Bible, that God, in his infinite love, a fierce love, an incredible love, condescended to the point where he would take on humanity and become the lowest of the low, a shepherd, and that he would actually give his life for stinking, dumb, distressed sheep like us. To think about that, there's really only two options you can walk away with. Either that is the most pretentious, narcissistic thing you've ever heard, that God would do that for somebody like me, or that's the greatest news that's ever been told, that the God of the universe would condescend and give his life up for you. Well, that's the truth. God loved you to that point, and what God is asking you to do is just simply to receive it. I've heard people say, so what am I supposed to do? You know, follow the Ten Commandments, clean myself up. No. You think God condescended to that point for you to do all that? He just wants you to receive the gift of the cross. And just to ask him, you know, if you really paid for the gift of forgiveness through the death of Jesus, I want to receive that. I remember making that decision 15 years ago. And I just had the sense of peace. I know some people say they're real happy and real excited and joyful. I just had that feeling like, man, like the biggest issue in my entire life was now solved. And that sense of peace and just relaxation to know I'm with God. You could have that here tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.